KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
I'm Carly Huckles. This week, we're bringing you a special Thanksgiving episode that features some stories we're most thankful for.
One of my favorites from this year is a piece on black holes, those adorably voracious little space anomalies with an endless appetite for whatever is around them.
And that sounds like my family at the dinner table.
but some scientists have found that these black holes can also help create new stars. I don't know about your family, but there is no way my uncles could do that.
There's also a growing possibility that Colorado could be the host for the 2030 Winter Olympics, but not everyone is so keen on that idea.
There's positives and negatives, but it's just hard to see an Olympics that hasn't had a horrific overrun.
A committee exploring a future Winter Olympics wonders if history is repeating itself.
We'll have these stories and much more. Plus, Howie Mofsovitz reviews a new documentary about a film star whose best work was 100 years ago, but somehow is still relevant and exciting today.
But first, Colorado recycles less than a quarter of its trash. That's according to the nonprofit Colorado Public Interest Research Group. KUNC's Desmond O'Boyle has more.
The report, titled The State of Recycling in Colorado, says Coloradans produced about 9.3 million tons of trash in 2017, and an average 12% of that was recycled. Coburg spokesperson Danny Katz says a statewide program will improve recycling.
We have a new governor coming in. Governor-elect Jared Polis has a lot of opportunity to basically coordinate and collaborate with local governments and businesses to help put Colorado on the right track.
Loveland and Boulder both recycle more than half of their trash, with rates of 61 and 52% respectively. Desmond O'Boyle, KUNC.
And now we hear more about trash, or more specifically, what do you do when you're about to run out of room to dump your garbage? Northern Colorado's only publicly owned landfill is almost full. And as KUNC's Matt Bloom reports, local governments are questioning the future of the region's waste management.
When the Larimer County landfill opened back in 1963, it was taking in about 50,000 tons of trash a year. Today, it averages about 350,000 tons annually.
Pretty busy.
For the past 40 years, Stephen Gillette has been managing Colorado's trash. Half of that time has been here, overseeing the site's day-to-day operations.
We have over, 6 million tons in place in this landfill.
This stretch of land, less than a square mile in size, is where most of the garbage from Estes Park, Fort Collins, and Loveland ends up. On some days, more than 1,000 trash trucks will roll through here. But the landfill is expected to reach its capacity by the end of 2024. So, with an ever-growing population, where will the trash go? Right now, there aren't any firm plans, but ideas are in the works.
We've narrowed it down to 5 recommended options for infrastructure.
Honoré Depue represents Fort Collins and the North Front Range Regional Waste Shed Coalition. They're researching how to best handle the future of Northern Colorado's trash. He shared the most promising ideas during a recent open house meeting. Chief among them is
a new county landfill.
That would be located in a swath of county-owned land north of Fort Collins near the town of Wellington. But it's not as simple as just dumping trash in another location. Depue says the key to sustainable growth is making sure everyone is on the same page.
Throughout Northern Colorado, people are living and working and traveling more and more in different areas. And so having consistency throughout the region, what we call the waste shed, makes it easier for everyone to sort of understand how to handle their waste materials.
The waste shed's population is set to double in the coming decades. And the trash it will produce, well, that's expected to reach 540,000 tons annually by 2025. That's why more recycling and composting facilities are also on the table.
I'm liking what I'm hearing.
Laurel Grimm was at the open house. She owns Dumpster Rental, a family hauling business in Fort Collins.
Going to the landfill as often as I do, I cannot believe how much furniture I see that goes in the landfill.
And to keep reusable items like that out of the new facilities, Ron Gilkerson, who's also on the coalition, says communities in Larimer County are going to have to agree on what waste materials go where.
We need process controls and ordinances that are adopted by our municipal partners to get the mixed waste to this facility so the county can put it on the ground. That's the next step.
Gilkerson hopes that will happen before the end of the year. because without them, they can't build anything. And remember, there's only 6 years left at the current landfill. And in the scheme of things, that's not a lot of time in trash years.
Just remember, there's only three things guaranteed in life: death, taxes, trash.
As we drive away from the landfill, Stephen Gillette tells me he's certain the region is ready for the next chapter of its waste management. Over the years, he's helped Larimer County build a capital investment fund of nearly $40 million from its profits. And now he's planning his retirement.
Before this closes, I'll be retired.
Oh, okay.
As I say, I'll be around for the setting of the table, but I might not be there for the banquet. And that's okay. I've done my damage and I can move on.
The North Front Range Regional Waste Shed Coalition has also studied doing nothing. While not likely to happen, trash would have to be outsourced to landfills in Weld County or Denver. The additional driving would emit 6,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere each year and push up monthly rates. For KUNC, I'm Matt Bloom.
I don't know about you, Carly, but we always seem to generate lots of extra trash and recycling after a big holiday get together.
That is always the way it goes.
I was thinking it's too bad we can't just send all of that into space and then feed it to a black hole. Like, that would take care of it.
Well, black holes are known for making everything in their vicinity vanish. They tend to get a bad rap as big, bad destroyers, but scientists have found that they can also be creators, even setting up conditions for a brand new batch of stars. Back in January, KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle talked with researchers who had found a black hole that was particularly active.
This 1979 Disney movie, appropriately called Black Hole, pretty much sums up the stereotype these invisible giants have gotten over the years.
It is unavoidable. Moving through space, swallowing everything in its path, radio waves, light, even planets and stars.
But CU astrophysicist Julie Comerford says they're really not that bad.
So that's a popular misconception that black holes are like vacuum cleaners and they're just sucking up everything they can around them. They're actually pretty gentle creatures as long as you don't get too close to them.
In fact, she says they're a lot like toddlers. The more they consume, the bigger they get. And they're messy eaters, especially supermassive black holes. Those can be millions of times larger than our own sun. And they're what Comerford studies.
Imagine, you know, you're trying to feed a kid dinner and the kid is pushing away some of the food. So some of the food gets eaten and then some of it gets thrown onto the floor.
Supermassive black holes, which have been found at the center of many galaxies, do that too. As they slurp up passing stars and gas, they also hurl a lot of material out into space. In a galaxy far, far away, Comerford and her colleagues recently discovered something interesting. Two clumps of light emanating from a black hole that were moving at a different velocity than everything else around them.
And so we wondered why that was.
So they took a closer look at that galaxy.
Its name is SESS J1354 plus 1327. Or we've been working on this galaxy for so many years that my graduate student started calling it the galaxy that will haunt our dreams.
Using data from four land and space-based telescopes, Comerford and her colleagues figured out those clumps of light were giant bursts of gas and energy that the black hole had tossed out during a meal, kind of like a toddler throwing spinach on the floor. As the researchers write in the Astrophysical Journal, those starry leftovers indicated that this particular black hole had consumed its meals just 100,000 years apart.
100,000 years is a long time for us, but in a cosmological context, that's really fast.
And though scientists had predicted that black holes could gorge themselves fairly often, until now they hadn't actually seen how frequently black holes eat and how they're able to build up their mass to become so big. The finding has people excited, including other astrophysicists not involved in the study, like Brooke Simmons at the University of California, San Diego.
We do know that black holes are important in the growth of galaxies somehow, but we don't really understand why and how that works.
One thing that is known is that when a supermassive black hole feeds, it can heat things up in a way that can lead to new stars. So this particular black hole may have created two bursts of brand new stars. Simmons says there are probably a lot of black holes across the universe behaving this way.
I mean, if these things are really just sort of feeding very frequently, that would help us to understand the patterns of star formation that we see in galaxies everywhere.
This isn't the only way stars are born, but it does show how supermassive black holes can shape the galaxies around them, including our own Milky Way. Our galaxy has a supermassive black hole at its center, too, called Sagittarius A star. Luckily for us, it's a very light eater. For now, that is. Julie Comerford says our black hole could have a feast headed its way.
Oh, yeah. So the Andromeda Galaxy is headed straight for us, and we're headed straight for them. And in 4 billion years, we're going to collide, and we're going to combine the two galaxies into like a new, I'm going to call it Mandromeda Galaxy.
But who knows what the Earth will look like then, or if it will even be around? Because there's a pretty dire situation forecasted for about that same time. The sun is expected to swell up and swallow the Earth whole. For KUNC, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
I know we have a lot more to get to, but because it's that time of year, I have to ask, what are you thankful for this holiday season, Erin?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I get to spend Thanksgiving with my in-laws, and they're not completely horrible, so that's a good thing. But, you know, seriously, I know it's a cliche, but I am really thankful for my family and my friends, my dogs, and just living here in this beautiful state of Colorado is amazing. And what about you, Carly?
As cheesy as it sounds, I'm definitely thankful for my husband and the little family that we're creating,
yes.
But also for every single dog I see on the street. Because when you're driving in your car and you just see a happy dog walking, that's what makes my day.
It brightens your day, for sure.
But I also took some time to drag a few staff members in the studio to hear what they're thankful for.
Hey, this is Kyra Buckley, Morning Edition host and reporter at KUNC. In this season of gratitude, I'm thankful for my Jazzercise Greeley community. You guys help keep me happy and healthy, and I am so grateful for all of your friendships.
Hi, I'm Matt Bloom. I'm a reporter with KUNC, and I'm thankful for my family this holiday season. My sister's a student at Colorado State University, and I get to spend so much time with her. It is the best.
Hi, I'm Desmond O'Boyle, All Things Considered host for KUNC. I'm thankful for everyone who called me randomly this past year just to say hi. It's always great to hear from old friends and family, especially when a lot of us assume that what we see on social media is enough. A phone call to check in goes a long way. I'm thankful for those phone calls this holiday season.
My name's Lee Patterson, and I'm a reporter with Guns in America at KUNC. I'm thankful for the opportunity to do this interesting and important work this holiday season.
Overall, I think I can speak for everyone at KUNC by saying we're thankful for you, our members, for making this podcast and everything that we do here at KUNC possible.
Yes, thank you. And now, before we get too far ahead of ourselves, why not? Let's get ahead of ourselves and think about the future, specifically the year 2030. Only two U.S. cities remain in contention for the 2030 Winter Olympics, and they're both in our region. At this point, it looks like a showdown between Denver and Salt Lake City. That's after Reno and Lake Tahoe dropped out of the running, saying that their joint bid was not financially viable. But there are plenty of people around here that are not on board with the idea of the Winter Olympics coming to Colorado. A committee created by the mayor of Denver has been weighing that very question recently. At a cost of up to $2 billion, the prospect is concerning to some groups, including one person who knows the pitfalls of making such a decision. KUNC's Michael DeJoanna brought us this story in May.
Colorado has a love-hate relationship with the Olympics. First, the love. There's that massive training center for athletes in Colorado Springs, and there were more Olympians from Colorado than any other state in the Games in South Korea this year. That's Eagle Vale skier Michaela Schifrin, overcome with joy after nabbing a gold medal in the giant slalom. And then there's the hate.
Denver offers the magic of the West, its adventure, tradition, and culture. But more than that, Denver wants to share its mountains, its competitive experience, and its facilities with all the world.
Since the start of the modern games back in 1896, Denver is and remains the only chosen city to ever reject the Olympics.
We hope we'll see you in 76.
But the Olympics never came to Colorado, partly because of this man.
Hi. Hi. Governor Lamb, Michael DeJoanna.
Hello, Michael.
With KUNC, how are you? Thank you.
Richard Lamb was governor of Colorado from 1975 to 1987. One of the milestones on his way to that job was his opposition to the games. Not that he's an Olympics hater.
Did you watch the Olympics this year?
I did.
Did you enjoy them?
I do enjoy the Olympics. Yeah, I do.
So what was his reasoning?
There's positives and negatives. But it's just hard to see an Olympics that hasn't had a horrific overrun, a cost overrun.
The 1976 Winter Games ultimately went to Innsbruck, Austria, which avoided costs because it hosted the Games before. But not all Games are winners. The 1976 Summer Games went to Montreal, Canada, and were supposed to cost $124 million. But taxpayers wound up $1.5 billion in debt. And the stories are similar elsewhere, for Beijing, for Sochi, and for Rio. So with that track record, why would anyone consider bringing the Olympics to Colorado in 2030 or 2034?
We need to be ready. And so that's where the committee is now.
Ramona Robinson is the spokeswoman for the Denver Olympics Exploratory Committee. It was formed last year by Denver Mayor Michael Hancock.
There's five different subcommittees working to put information together and answering really two questions. Not only could we host a Winter Olympic Games in the future, but should we? Is it the right thing for Colorado?
The main 37-member Exploratory Committee is a who's who of Colorado, representing business, government, community, and sports. Even former Denver Broncos quarterback Peyton Manning is on it. They have to figure out how to come up with at least $2 billion. About half of that would come from the International Olympic Committee.
And so then that here's what we need to raise is what we're looking at privately financing through ticket sales, sponsorships, merchandising, and things like that.
The idea that it can be done privately is questionable, but that is how they are selling it.
As a community activist, Christine O'Connor has been watching closely. Even with private funding, she says taxpayers could wind up on the hook for things that few consider, like International Olympic Committee contract obligations.
They don't want to risk that profit by having to cover cost overruns or having to cover risk associated with, heaven forbid, terrorism or some other event that postpones the games. There's a lot of risk involved.
To address concerns, the Denver Exploratory Committee has reached out. It's even included mountain towns in the conversation. Yet some feel the process has been too secretive because the committee's meetings are not open to the public. Jeff Roberts is with the Colorado Freedom of Information Coalition, a nonprofit that acts as a watchdog of government activities.
There is that sunshine law, and it does seem to say that an advisory board or a body that's given a decision-making function by someone in government, like the mayor, should open the process to the public and maybe follow the process that's in the law.
Ramona Robinson defends keeping the meetings closed. She says the committee isn't being run by the city. Rather, it's under the Denver Sports Commission, a private nonprofit. Also,
most everything that's talked about at the exploratory committee level could be proprietary information that could compromise other folks knowing about it if we did get to a bid process.
The committee's recommendation could come later this month. And activists like Christine O'Connor are predicting it will tell the mayor to say yes to the Winter Games. They've responded with a No Olympics movement that aims to go to Denver voters and ask them if they want the last say on hosting any future Olympics, regardless of what the committee decides.
When I asked friends and hairdressers and other people about this randomly, they all remember 1972, and they all said, well, we got to vote. We'll get to vote on this, surely. And I try to explain, no, you might not.
There was a number of people in Colorado that almost considered me a traitor to the state because this was a big state effort, and why shouldn't we want to show Colorado off?
If history is repeating itself, Richard Lamb is content to let others take the lead this time. His efforts back in the 1970s still loom large over the state and himself. He says money isn't the only reason people might oppose the Olympics.
There was a groundswell of opposition to the Olympics, saying we can hardly handle the growth we have. Colorado was the second or third fastest growing state at the time, and people were saying, why take this financial risk to add to growth that we can hardly manage as it is?
Colorado is still growing fast, ninth in terms of percentage of population gain, according to the Census Bureau. The question now is whether Coloradans feel welcoming the Olympic Games will be a positive or a negative. For KUNC, I'm Michael DeOanna.
Now let's take a look back to one of our favorite stories from when the StoryCorps mobile booth was in Fort Collins. Liz Barnes and Lori Daigle came to the booth to tell the story of their remarkable relationship. After falling for each other as teenagers in New Orleans, they fell out of touch for years until a chance encounter on Facebook brought them back together.
We were growing up in New Orleans, good Catholic girls, and both of us played sports for rival high schools. I was on the junior varsity team, and you were on the varsity team, and so we watched varsity play first. And I remember watching you play because you were such an amazing athlete, and you had a cute nose. We played against each other practice games and things like that, so I remember meeting you then.
I was just thinking about the way we felt about each other in the summer of 81. We just knew something was going on, but we didn't know how to even talk about it or describe it.
For me, I was, you know, having some feelings, but didn't quite know what those were because we were good Catholic girls and we had no role models back in the 80s for what that even was. But there was definitely an attraction. And I think one of those nights we kissed. I can't remember. But I do remember when we used to tour with the softball team, we'd go on the road and we'd sleep in the same bed and we'd hold hands under the covers. I remember that.
Yes, I remember that too. I actually remember that first kiss. We drove out to the parking lot of Lake Pontchartrain.
Oh, Pontchartrain Beach? At the beach at Pontchartrain Beach. Yeah.
Yes.
You'll have fun. You'll have fun every day of the week.
I remember that. And I remember never being so afraid and so excited in my entire life. I've just had adored you for so long, but we were so young and we weren't supposed to feel that the way that we felt. So it was frightening loving you the way I did.
I remember being really scared because we kissed and then we never talked about it with each other even.
Right.
I remember that we just kind of went about business as usual. And then you went off to college and I stayed in New Orleans. We lost touch.
I was always afraid to tell my parents how I was feeling. When I did at 19, that didn't go well at all.
Yeah.
And it really made life, you know, difficult for me, you know, who am I? Because I knew what I wanted and I knew who I wanted to be, but it led to how do I get back into my family? And in doing so, I guess the answer to that was to get married to a man and have children. And that's what I did for 17 years. What did you do in that time?
I started playing in bands and singing in bands in New Orleans on Bourbon Street. Then I came to Colorado, Fort Collins, and started playing music here and writing songs.
2 weeks after my divorce was final, you and I reconnected on Facebook 28 years later. And all the old memories, all the old feelings, everything just came flooding back.
Then after we connected, you came out to Colorado to visit, you know, it's like, well, let's see if we can get together.
I just saw you and all I wanted to do was kiss you again.
So 28 years later,
in the parking lot of DIA.
In the parking lot of DIA. So romantic. We had learned how to kiss over the years.
Had a little more confidence.
Should we end with a song?
I think we should end
with a song. At the beach, at the beach, at Pontchartrain Beach. You'll have fun every day of the week.
Lori and Liz were married in 2015, and if that's not something to be grateful for, I don't know what is.
Agreed.
StoryCorps is sponsored locally by Kaiser Permanente.
You know, one of the downsides of the holidays for many people is relatives arguing at the table. Politics, religion, whatever. But StoryCorps believes Thanksgiving is a time to listen. They started a national movement that's called the Great Thanksgiving Listen to encourage everyone, but especially young people, to help create an oral history of the United States by recording a conversation with an elder in their family or a friend or a family friend. They even have a mobile app so that anyone can record and archive a special conversation that can then be uploaded to the StoryCorps archive at the Library of Congress.
The new documentary, The Great Buster, A Celebration, chronicles the life and career of one of the greatest movie clowns. For KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, Buster Keaton's films still amaze and are a delight for all audiences.
Buster Keaton's simply a marvel of brilliance and joy, but it's not really that simple.
He became a star in 1917, over 100 years ago. Yet I've never known someone to keep thinking that Keaton's movies are just old, outdated, silly stuff after they've actually seen him work. Keaton's comedy cuts through those 100 years, and watching him in action feels timeless. Great silent comedy takes you into a dream state where the improbable is perfectly believable, the world is just enough askew to free you from worrying about normal logic, and no one gets hurt. When Keaton does one of his masterful arcing falls, his body describing a chaotic but nearly perfect circle, you know he will get up undamaged and continue on his way. He was called the Great Stone Face, but he's not without expression. He stares out at the world in a kind of uncomprehending wonder at its mysteries. In The Navigator, Keaton's stuck with just his lady love on a drifting ocean liner. In Seven Chances, he faces a huge avalanche with car-sized rocks tumbling down a hill at him. In Steamboat Bill Jr., a mythically unhinged wind and rainstorm throws houses and trees at him, but he figures out how to harness a range of human devices. To rescue his father from a jailhouse floating in a river, to pluck his girlfriend from a sinking riverboat, to fish her father from the river, and finally to snag a minister to perform a waterlogged marriage. Keaton may have been the first genuinely 20th century artist in American movies. Chaplin and D.W. Griffith were certainly equal geniuses to Keaton, but their art came from the 19th century. They were interested in the social world and character. Keaton took on the nature of film itself. He made jokes about what the camera could or could not see. In his 1924 masterpiece, Sherlock Jr., Keaton made brilliant and hilarious jokes about how film and actuality are not the same and work according to entirely different rules. Keaton even made jokes about physics, whether two vectors would intersect, or how motion and energy could be transferred from one object to another. There's no finer movie than Steamboat Bill Jr. about a human being at the mercy of an unconcerned universe, and Keaton gets to it through comedy. Keaton and Chaplin are often compared, and film scholars sometimes take sides, which I think is pointless. They're different from each other. They only appeared together in one film, Chaplin's 1953 Limelight, with Chaplin as an aging clown on stage for the last time. And for one scene, he brings in his assistant, played by Keaton. Actor Norman Lloyd, who was in the film as a very young man, described it as two geniuses collaborating with each other. Peter Bogdanovich's documentary is the best thing I've seen about Keaton's career and his life. I hadn't known how much great work in small bits Keaton had done in television and even in commercials. Bogdanovich traces Keaton's life and then settles into an appraisal of the 10 remarkable features Keaton made in just 5 years in the 1920s. Bogdanovich's movie makes you realize that this great genius is still available to us. Take your kids. Keaton plays so friendly and inviting a character that in a minute kids forget the absence of speech and the black and white. They find Buster reassuring, a little like Mr. Rogers. Keaton's appeal to anyone at any time comes from a comedy that's not about insults, but instead about how maybe the only way to understand the big, wide, scary universe is to laugh at our predicament. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofsovitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members. We are thankful for you. Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with producer Ryan Thompson and editors Brian Larson and Ashley Jeffcoat, who also manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. We also heard Lee Rosevier with Thank You for Holding, The Gold Lining by Broke for Free, SRO with I Miss Summer,
Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong, Squire Tuck with Thank Your Lucky Stars, Poddington Bear with Blossoming, Thank You for This World by Vortex, and our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.